This is John Abrams, and this is The Variety Artist, episode 63. How can a guy do The Tonight Show, work with some of the biggest names in Hollywood, perform in Vegas and on cruise ships, and we've never even heard of him? Well, folks, Michael wrote the book on that, and you'll hear all about it here. Also, this is the first guest that literally got off the stage of America's Got Talent just a few days before the interview. I'm releasing this interview on June 10th of 2019. Michael will be on AGT on June 11th. That means that he could be on your TV and on your phone at the same time. Have fun.
Welcome to The Variety Artist, providing aspiring artists and entertainers with in-depth discussions from top performers from all over the world. So get ready to book some gigs, make some money, and have some fun with your host, John Abrams.
Ventriloquist, comedian, writer, director, radio producer, and host, and so much more. Now the author of the critically acclaimed book, Breaking Out of Show Business. His TV credits include The Tonight Show, Saturday Night Live, AGT, The Grammys, Sex in the City. I could go on and on, but instead, let's talk to him. Variety artist, I give you Michael Paul.
Come on, go on and on.
I should just continue.
It's only you and my mother that want to do it. That's right. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm good. I can tell that this is a Variety Act podcast because you didn't make me do this interview at like 8 a.m.
That's right, huh?
Yeah, we all work late, you know. Although, as I will say that now that I'm in my 40s and getting older, I can't sleep late. Like, you know, we used to work late, do the club, you hang out with friends, you sleep late. Now I can't do it. I wake up at, I turn over at 7:30 every morning. It's really annoying. No matter how tired I am, my eyes open, I'm like, mother of God, if I turn over and that clock says 7:30, I'm going to go bananas. And of course it's 7:30.
Oh, you and me both. I do school assemblies and I have to be set up and ready to go by sometimes by 8 or 8:30. So I wake up every morning at 5 o'clock. So even on a Sunday, I'll wake up and I'll turn over, I'll look at the clock and it'll be 5 o'clock or 5:30 in the morning.
It's annoying. It's some old man nonsense. And also, you know, when I do get to sleep late or when I can, now I can't because they're doing construction across the street from me and they are sending a food truck to the workers at 8 a.m. and the food truck beeps, instead of a beep, it beeps La Cucaracha. The entire song, like three times. I'm like, why? Why the entire song? The third week they were waking me up every day. I stormed down there and I'm like, your horn keeps waking up my baby.
Oh,
hoping that would help. Now I don't have a baby, but you know,
you are your baby.
It's true. You're not the first person that said that.
No. All right. So I always joke that I'm the most famous guy that you've never heard of, but yeah. I read your credits and I am far from the most famous guy you've never heard of. You are the most famous guy I've never heard of.
Yeah, I've skyrocketed to the middle.
Yeah.
In fact, the byline of the book is what I've discovered by not being discovered. That was the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
You're right, though. And I should mention that, you know, the book was not self-published. To your point is that they came to me because they said, you know, we don't know who you are. You know, you've had these five different careers alongside all these famous people for almost 30 years. It's and we don't know, no one knows who you are. And we think it's interesting. I said, oh, that's so nice because I find it irritating.
Yeah.
Most people that are working variety acts are not household names. You just keep chugging along.
You've done so many different things. I mean, like writing and directing and coaching and ventriloquism, but you're public. Well, you know what? Let's start with a couple of days ago. You were at AGT, right?
Yes, I did. I finally, you know, I'm sure my mother's done AGT at this point. So the thing about having this long list of bucket list things of creative things that I've done was mainly because, you know, a lot of variety acts, some variety acts, their show is a mishmash. And it's maybe because they're just piecing things together, but they don't really have an act. And for me, it was really just, I was so interested in so many aspects of entertainment that, you know, I'd start doing something and then I'd cross paths with something and then I'd go another way. And it was really just a bucket list kind of thing. But as far as AGT goes, you know, all of my friends have done it. In the first 10 years, I didn't do it because I, you know, I thought it was trashy. It's not like being invited to The Tonight Show where you're like the guest and you're made to look good, you know.
Right.
It was a reality show as well. And those producers at that time were there to make you look dumb. Right. So I didn't want to do that. And then towards the end, like the last 10 years, my act consists of ventriloquism, but my strength is that I am a personality without the ventriloquism. I was a stand-up first, an improv guy. I do a ton of serious, heavy crowd work.
Mm-hmm.
not just the, you know, where you're from, what do you do, but stuff that really goes somewhere. And that's what kind of makes the show interesting, which does not work in a 2 minute period on AGT.
Right.
So of course they wanted a very small scope being the ventriloquism. And I knew that. They'd asked me for a lot of years, as you know, they scour the internet and the referred and they ask people, but you know, all these other ventriloquists, they sang, they do impressions, they have a lot of gadgets. Mm-hmm. I was going to have to like set myself on fire to even be remotely interesting. And I was concerned, you know, I didn't want it to hurt my brand by being judged poorly.
Oh yeah. And back to your point, I think it's a different time now. 10 years ago, 8 years ago, 7 years ago with that and American Idol, they used to focus so much on the negative. Right?
Right.
But now, with The Voice and AGT cutting a little differently, they're really looking for spectacular acts.
I was in very long conversations with the casting people, and they said, you know, those were a separate set of producers. Our goal is to have a positive impact. Now, that being said, they'll say whatever they want to get you to do it because they need talent. There's certain things I can't talk about, but, you know, obviously not all the acts are legit acts or real acts or whatever. That was one of my bigger concerns. And I'm not ashamed to afraid that for a long time I ignored it. I was afraid of that show. I didn't want to be judged. I thought maybe I had passed my, you know, my time and I was going to be, you know, cheesy and hacky and outdated. I mean, all those things, even though I work really hard at changing the material and not wearing the same clothes that I wore 10 years ago and all of that kind of stuff. So
yeah.
I was afraid. And then finally, I'm just like, about 2 years ago, I kind of had a little midlife crisis. I was unhappy with where I was at in my work and in my life. I felt like my life had kind of stalled a little bit. And through a series of epiphanies, I decided that I was going to say yes to things and not have the expectancy of a result and just really be present without a lot of story attached to it. So this was really asking me to put my money where my mouth was. So I asked a bunch of friends of mine. I'm like, should I do it? What should I do? Does anyone really care about season 14 on AGT? And they said, look, you know, even if you don't make it through when you're on the show, from a business standpoint, people see the word AGT and they still fill in the seats. They still pay extra money. They're still interested. And generally, people don't remember, the audiences don't really remember what you did on the show. It's really just word association. But my bigger concern was, you know, what my peers would think, what my bookers would think. And that bothered me for a long time. And I just wanted to throw that away and do it for me. I agreed. I called the casting guy back and I said, all right, look, I'll do it, but I don't want to audition. I want to go right to the TV round. He's like, okay. I'm like, and then I'm like, if it doesn't go well, I don't want it to air. And he's like, okay, fine.
Go.
And then just to be a diva, I go, and how long do I have to sit around with all those yahoos backstage?
Okay.
And he's like, oh, we'll give you a hard out, you know, whatever. If you someone that, now, for those who don't know, a hard out is if you're on a studio set and you have another appointment,
right?
The latest you can be there at 2 o'clock. So he's like, oh, we'll give you a hard out. I'm like, oh, I want a hard out, a hard on, everything hard. I want it all hard. So yeah, so I agreed to do, can I say that on here?
Sure, what the heck?
I agreed to, well, you said heck, now I feel bad. So I did it. It was a fascinating experience. It's a huge machine. Now, I can't really give away what's going to happen, but, you know, I really made a point of making sure they didn't produce me the way they produced everybody else. It's kind of cookie cutter. But, you know, the bottom line is it is a talent show. It is a reality show and it is produced reality. And there are certain things that are out of your control. Mm-hmm. There are certain things that I have been thrilled with and certain things that really I was not happy with and I was upset with. But in the end, the stuff that bothered me is really my own psyche and concerns. And I think we'll have very little merit. It's going to be great to be a part of a national campaign I have a heavy production resume. And so I really enjoyed stepping up and participating in that. There's a lot of behind the scenes stuff, you know, and we'll see what happens. We'll see what it does for me brand wise.
Yeah. And the truth is when you put that on your website, there is power when you see the judges saying something about you, there's power in that testimonial.
That's right. And if they like you in one round and someone hates you in the other, well, that's like going to a regular show. Hey, I like that part of the guy's act and I didn't like that part. I mean, of course it's not on international television where someone's saying that, but I think for the most part, people know that, you know, if Simon Cowell is going to be a bad guy, that's just what he does.
Right.
And I think for the most part, people are pretty smart, except for, you know, if you're living in Arizona. Or
anybody in Arizona listening to this, did he just say that?
And I love Arizona. I was just there for 2 months performing. They were great. You're right about that. It's a PR thing. you know, you brand it and you use what works and you throw away what doesn't. And
yeah, exactly. And 5 years later, nobody's going to remember what was said. All they're going to see is that video on your website having Howie Mandel say, hey, he was great or whatever he says.
Exactly. And from a business standpoint, it's important. Look, I mean, for me personally, I'm not doing it to be a star ventriloquist in Las Vegas. I don't care about that. That's not my life focus. I have other things. You know, I care about the act and I want to stay happy while I'm doing it, because when I used it to pay the bills and I wasn't nurturing it, I became depressed and I hated what I was doing. But at the same time, you know, I have expanded far, far past that. And frankly, I did Las Vegas already. I had that experience. And to me, just being a ventriloquist puts me in a box that I don't like.
And that's why you're doing all the different things, coaching and directing and writing.
Right. So, you know, I started out in every area of the business. I started out in production and then went into performance. You know, I was a kid and I was a bad student. I was bored. And so I did the work study program, which most kids use for vocational education. And Philadelphia, where I grew up, was the fourth largest market. So all the test shows for the networks would come through.
Okay.
I was one of the youngest interns at NBC, and I was privy to all of this stuff. People who are now the executive producers of like the Ellen DeGeneres Show were my mentors when I was 16 or 17. And then I moved into production performance. I was the eyewitness teen reporter. And then that internship ended. And then I, you know, if I didn't find another, I'd have to go back to school full time. So I was in radio. And then I did a local dinner theater where I met all these Las Vegas show variety acts that came through, and that's kind of how that started. So now this whole thing about having a series of successful one-offs in my life that never turned into anything in particular and having all these different careers really made me a great director and writer for other people, you know, to direct the writing process for a singer or dancer or magician without tainting their voice with your agenda. Now I have this box of tools to unlock people, and it's been so wonderfully satisfying.
As variety artists, we are our own directors and producers and writers. We do the whole thing ourselves. So it's always good to have an outside eye.
That's right. And there's something wonderful about that. You know, I mean, it's emotionally taxing because you're working for yourself. You're your own cheerleader. You have to figure everything out. When you're first directing yourself and creating, that's great. That's why you went in to do your own act. But after a certain amount of time, you only know what you know.
Yep.
And I think that, you know, everyone wants to give their opinion. And a lot of times it's not your style and you kind of roll your eyes and you're like, all right, well, that's not for me. So you got to really find people that are legitimate and also well-rounded enough to give you information that's going to help you get out of your box.
What have you found are kind of the most common problems that performers like myself, you know, that have their own show? What do you find something that's most common, the most common obstacles they go through?
I do. So a lot of people come up with a show first. Oh, it's going to be this and I'm going to look like that. And here's the name. I'm like, okay, but, and the show's going to be about this. And then they build it around that idea or the manufactured idea, as opposed to really digging into some of the truth of what that they're coming up with the PR about it before they even really know what the show is. A lot of singers come to me and they say, here's what the show is going to be about. And here's all the songs I chose. And I'll say, okay, well, why this song or why that song or why are you talking about that? And the answers are very shallow and it's going to give you a very bad short shelf life. And also a lot of it has been done and the audience can really sense a lack of legitimacy. And those sort of choices also don't give you a lot of dynamics. This one magician came to me, very talented, does a lot of work for other people. And he's telling me all these stock tricks. And I said, well, listen, let me ask you this. What is it in life you're really good at? And he said, like, oh, drinking. He was kidding. And I said, you're kidding, but great. I said, instead of a magic cart, roll out a bar. You know, all of your tricks can have, you know, drinks and glasses and umbrellas and olives. And after every trick, you drink it. And then by the end, you're drunk, you know, something like that. Or I had another magician who all the magicians seem to want to be mystical and wear black flowing shirts. And even when you're ordering at a restaurant, I'll have the salmon. You know, they're just crazy. And I had this one guy said, listen, when I look at you, that's not who you are. You are the dad next door that's mowing the lawn. I said, and I know that disappoints you, but the more you know what your product is, the more we can build around that and the material is going to spill out onto the page. I also find that I have to break a lot of magicians of doing that magician way of speaking, which is kind of like a newscaster when they go, more with the weather tonight at 11. Or they'll say, and now the metamorphosis, you know, that kind of thing. I'm like, you don't talk like that. And also in today's day and age, a lot of older acts, ventriloquists, magicians, they don't realize that the role nowadays is not playing the role of the stage magician. It's being the most yourself. That's what audiences want. And that's what they connect with. And otherwise they will disconnect. I'm going on a long harangue.
No, that's okay. You know, you can't see me right now, but I'm nodding my head. Yes.
I had a singer, Brandon James. His career is blowing up. He and his show partner, Brandon was a singer. He was a like an opera singer, a Michael Bublé type. Mm-hmm. And he was partnering with this guy who's a cellist, but they wanted to be equals, not looking like the magician that's backing him up. But Brandon, coming from that background, all those kind of singers, they think it's about the voice and about the song. And so on stage, they're kind of like studio performers, not stage performers. And mm-hmm. he was not comfortable, not legit, not comfortable in his dialogue. It was all scripted and his body language was very tight. We were in a studio and workshopped it and using different tricks that I had to originate with what he needed to get him to have an authentic performance with the audience. Mm-hmm. And that's the same with singers and magicians and tap dancers and anybody. So I'm really I'm going on a long rant because I'm so passionate about it. But
no, it's true. It's everything you're saying is true.
And by the way, because I started out as I was a stage tech. Because I had behind the scenes and in front and in multimedia, I can also assist someone in what needs to be bigger and what needs to be more intimate and how to utilize, you know, all the layers in one transitional moment. I used to have a big show. I used to have the band and I had charts and I had things, I had lighting cues and all that. You know, and doing a one-nighter, that's very challenging. And eventually I wasn't enjoying it. One, it was hard because, you know, you're there for one night and you're in charge of a lot of people. And two, I had trouble then enjoying what I was doing, concentrating on the act. You know, I was getting kind of Las Vegas-y cabaret and I wanted to get more mainstream, legit, today comedy style. So when I go to a big room and a huge stage, I have to pull in the stage. I lower the electrics. I pull in the curtains. I light it where I'm not lighting up the whole stage, but I'm utilizing layers. Or I'll do the opposite. If I'm on a cruise ship and it's the room that everybody's using every night and the pre-show sensibility is the same, it all looks the same, I'll do something completely different. I will strip the stage away. I'll tear away all the curtains. I'll light up the guts of the room. Oh. Because, you know, we all know it's not only the dialogue, but it's eye focus. I think it's so funny how, you know, comedians, they're like, oh, I'll just have a whitewash and I'll be fine.
Yeah.
Which totally works. Like the material, if the material works, you can work anywhere for the most part. But I certainly think that people disrespect stand-up comedians thinking you can do comedy in the back of a bar, you know, with people not facing you and loud music playing. Mm-hmm. I think that eye focus is important. Sight lines are important. Setting up the audience beforehand. I always bring my own pre-show music because you leave it up to the people in charge and they'll put on like, I don't know, Evergreen or I don't know.
Yeah,
you know,
I always bring my own pre-show music.
Of course.
You have to. Yeah, it sets the tone for whatever you're going to do.
It certainly does. To your point about how to set up the room, you know, we're an independent contractor. And once we get in there, our rules of the show supersede how they run things, you know? So I always tell them, look, you know, your office paid for me to produce the show. And I, you know, hope that you will support me in doing that. And that includes sometimes I have room music, I have a pre-show video and all that, but sometimes I don't let the hosts introduce me. If I know that they're long talkers or they're hacky or they're going to make me have to pull the people up out of the basement because they're slow or they're so busy doing a joke that they forget my name.
Yeah.
I do a cold open. I don't need the audience to be revved up. I'm also a sadomasochist. Like I feel like if I don't deserve the applause because I haven't done anything yet, that I have to work for it. So I don't necessarily need someone to rev up the audience right away.
Yeah. There's a magician named Joshua Jay who just did a study on increasing, entertainers' perception to the audience. And one of the things that he discovered is that a pre-recorded or some sort of an important announcement of you before your entertainment increases the perceived value in the audience's mind.
Pre-recorded is the key. Mm. You know, most people know this, but you go on after dinner, but yep, before the awards and the speeches.
Right.
And a lot of people think that the entertainment should be the big finish. But we all know, you and I know that that's wrong because by the end of the evening, they're tired, they have food coma, they got their award, they want to go home and pay the babysitter. You don't know what people are going to say in their speeches. There's some corporate guy that wants to do a little sketch with the CEO. It's always terrible.
Oh, yeah.
I had someone go on and get an award and talk about the Holocaust for a half hour before I went on stage. I was going berserk.
Oh, fun. 6 million people died. Ladies and gentlemen, Michael Paul.
For 30 minutes. And so, you know, you can't ignore it. So I went on and I'm like, you know, nothing really helps a comedy evening than talking about the Holocaust for, I really have to bring it. I'm like, so before we move any forward, would anyone like to talk about abortion or perhaps slavery? Let's get it all out of the way. You know, you're in a good mood. In my agreement, it says, you know, you're hiring, whether it's as a director or whatever, you're hiring me as a, you know, I don't know what it says, like as a professional, and I will consult you on the best way to execute this. And if you choose to not listen to me, then I am not responsible for the outcome.
The thing about that is that the person that's reading that contract, they may agree to it and they may understand that you're not responsible, but the audience doesn't know that.
Yes, but honestly, I get more less agita from the audience concern than I do from the client.
Oh.
But all that business side does still make me a little jittery because I had a very traumatic thing happen many years ago. You know, we all have our horror stories. You know, that still sits with me a little bit.
Well, I can't let that go by without asking what happened. If you don't mind telling, or if you do mind telling, tell me.
No, I don't mind. I've gone through therapy.
Okay.
First of all, let me just say that I think when you first start working, you'll take any job to be paid. Eventually, you learn to find your audience, and you're able to say to clients, I am not the act for you, which people are shocked about. Mm-hmm. At the point in my career, and God, this must have been, I don't even know how long. It could have been 15, 20 years ago. I had already been touring with a lot of names, and I had been doing, I did a lot of casino shows and those, you know, Las Vegas review shows and everything. I'd done quite a bit of corporate, and I was fine. I mean, I don't consider myself a clean act, but I'm certainly not dirty. I don't curse and all that stuff, but I talk about adult things, divorce and marriage and all that or whatever. And I want to be able to speak freely.
Yeah.
I'm not Jay Leno. So mm-hmm. I'm doing a casino show and a guy comes up to me with his wife who was friends with the singer in the show. They came to see her and he basically said, I own this company and every year we do this stockholders meeting and we have entertainers and usually we have singers, like, you know, big celebrity singers, but I'd love to have you. You're amazing. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, all right, well, here's my card and let's talk about it. So I come to find out he's like a Fortune 500, huge industry guy, really big deal. And he owns a Southern based healthcare company.
Okay.
And basically, when we started talking, I said, you know, what you and your wife enjoyed in a cabaret setting, I don't think will be appropriate for a Southern corporate thing. Right. No. It's going to be great. And it was a name your price sort of thing. Mm-hmm. Blank check. And he goes, and you're going to be opening for Amy Grant. I'm like, oh, great. Now, I didn't really know Amy Grant at the time, but if anyone does, she used to be a Christian singer, and then she went into pop.
Right.
So this guy, you know, I found out he had a bit of an ego. He would hire celebrities to be in his band because he liked to play guitar. He had a museum to himself in his own building. Mm-hmm. So over a six-month period, he assigns me to his vice president. Something in me just felt like this was not right. Now, coincidentally, aside from the girl that was friends with them, that the CEO would pay for her to have studio sessions at Sony Country. And my mother coincidentally was working for the company in Philadelphia. And then she got laid off. And then the CEO during this time called me and said, oh, we're embarrassed. And they gave her like a free job, like free money. Like she had nothing to do. They're like, oh, we're going to give her job back. She's nothing to do. I'm like, Mom, when I finish doing the show, they're going to fire you. So enjoy the money. So basically over a 6 month period, I give the CEO all this footage to review, to make sure they know what I'm doing. And they're like, yeah, it's going to be great. I fly to the venue. I have an assistant. I do an afternoon performance that went well. And it's like three ballrooms long and there's cameras and there's celebrities and everything. It goes fine. Then the evening performance happens and they're running late and I don't get a rehearsal. Mm-hmm. And they never had an act before with cues and all that kind of stuff. And the wife is in charge of the evening. And she says, so what are you going to do? I said, oh, I'm going to do what you saw at the casino. And she's like, oh, you can't do that here.
Oh no.
And I said, well, why are you telling me this now before I went on? And I am going nuts. And the CEO walks in with his security. I walk right up to him. I said, you understand what I'm going to do tonight, right? He goes, yeah, it's going to be great. I go on. They had asked me to cut 10 minutes because everyone was running long.
Yep.
And I wasn't doing poorly, but because there was no delay system on the sound system, I was getting a laugh in the first ballroom, then the second ballroom, and the third. It would go in waves. So it wasn't one huge laughter throughout the thing.
I call that a marinating laugh.
Right. So I wasn't sucking, but to the CEO sitting down front, I could tell he was getting fidgety. So I'm almost done. And little do I know, Amy Grant backstage says, we want to go on. This is running too long. And they want me to get off stage. Well, instead of blinking a light or giving me a cue or whatever, I'm on my last track, my last cue, but they don't know that because I didn't get a rehearsal. And they decide to stop playing my cues. Well, as a professional, I think something's broken. So I start stretching. So they want me off and I'm stretching.
Fun.
I'm a young kid. I'm in my 20s. And, you know, eventually I ran out of material and I have flop sweat. It is silent. And the only thing I can think of is an old joke about a priest and a nun on a two-hump camel.
Oh, no.
Right. So I'm two lines into this joke. And all of a sudden, the CEO was given a mic. He storms up on stage. He puts me in a headlock. He turns me away from the audience, but it kind of looks like he's giving me the, hey, buddy, how you doing thing. But there's fire in his eyes. And then he pushes me off stage. And I don't know what's happening, really. I'm waving like, hey, thanks. Good night, everybody. You know,
of course.
And he goes on an evangelical tirade about how I'm smut and trash and sending me to hell for about 6 minutes. We don't condone this sort of smut. Yeah. And I'm off stage and the crew is like, thanks a lot, jerk. Like they all hate me. And I'm supposed to be paid the second half of my money after this. So I go to my room, I'm losing my mind and I'm so upset. You know, my mother is like, you know, don't go after him, just go home. I'm like, they still owe me money. Like we were equals when we signed this contract. The worst part was I go downstairs the next morning, I'm going to the plane, whatever. And some of the people that saw me, some thought I was funny and he was a jerk. Some didn't get if that was a bit. Some people thought I was trash. And I'm sitting on a plane with these people and it was humiliating. Ugh. So I go home, I write a 3-page fax because we're faxing back then. And I basically said, you breached your contract. First of all, he put his hands on me. Second of all, no one reviewed the material. I didn't get my rehearsal and so on and so forth. And I expect to be paid within a 24-hour period, the balance.
Yeah.
So then I get a FedEx with the check and they basically said, we disagree with your assessment, which of course they will. What are they going to say? And then the worst part is they cut off guilt by association. My girlfriend who was a singer, they cut her off from using the studio. My mom got fired. Like it was a whole thing. Now, 6 months later, the guy went to prison for stock fraud manipulation and one of the biggest scams in healthcare history.
Mm.
But I got to tell you, it ruined me for like 2 years. I mean, and not to name drop, but I told Don Rickles this story. I was opening for him. And he's like, look, just because you don't work a particular audience doesn't mean you're a limited performer. Find your audience and that's where you work. But it took me a long time. Like anytime I heard like a Southern accent or someone questioned me about the material I was going to do, I'd have to go into the bathroom and sit there for an hour because my stomach was bothering me so bad.
Oh, wow.
It certainly made me in more control of the situations I will put myself in to make sure people are absolutely clear and the kind of jobs that I take.
You originally said right after your act that they saw to hire you, you said, well, I'm not sure if my act is exactly what you want. For that.
I told him it wasn't. He didn't want to hear it. I told him many, many times and sent them tons of material, but I should have listened to my gut, but I was young. I didn't know. And I had done corporates before, and it was just one of those things. So, yeah. I mean, that's the worst. And we've all had other experiences, but yeah, it was awful.
That sounds awful.
But look, the bottom line is you gotta be in the game. You gotta be on the field. You gotta show up.
Yep. Yep. All right. So we're going to switch gears a little bit. Tell us about your book, Something Happy and Fun.
Yes. This book came from years of not knowing where I belonged in show business. I've always had multiple careers and really just wonderful experiences that many times never turned into anything else for some reason. Not because it didn't go well, just because that's the kind of job it was. So on a Monday, I'm doing my act in Las Vegas or opening for an icon. On a Tuesday, I was puppeteering for the Muppets. On a Wednesday, I was faxing jokes to David Letterman. On a Thursday, I'm directing an award show and so on and so on and so on.
Dang.
A couple of years ago, I kind of, like I said, I felt kind of stale. I didn't know what I wanted to do. I couldn't figure out how to move forward. And I was frustrated with where I was at and I decided I was going to quit and I was just going to go do a regular job. And I got a resume together. I went to a career coach. I mean, I was all in with this. And then I got a call from a publishing company who asked me to write this book. Mm-hmm. The agreement was that I'd write the good, the bad, and the ugly of this kind of thing. I also was going to use it as a bit of therapy to be really honest with where I messed up and all that kind of stuff. And also, of course, list, you know, 40 or 50 celebrity stories without getting sued.
Yeah.
But I had said to them, I said, listen, if you think that my career is going to help you sell books, you are mistaken. That's what the whole book is about.
Yeah.
You know, if you think I'm going to help you with this success, we shouldn't do it at all because I didn't want to be responsible for someone else's failure. So, you know, we did the book, they believed in it. I got some wonderful reviews. We had it was kind of a weak launch. The PR guy of their company quit at that, the week of the launch. But, you know, they said, look, we believe in this book and it, you know, we think it can have a long life. And these are the people that did like the Real Housewives books and Leslie Jordan and, you know, people like that. So it was very, very therapeutic. It was very special. And then what's funny is, you know, the end of the book talks about how I'm quitting goodbye. And now I haven't quit. So the book went into reprint about 6 months ago. And I said, listen, before it goes into reprint, I want to do an epilogue and explain myself. And so we put in all the critics' reviews and all that stuff. And then I explained how I had retired the mindset and how I did that and where I'm at now. And I think those last pages are really important. And for anyone who knows me out there who's listening, who has bought the book, I'll happily just send you a free PDF of the final pages because I really think it is instrumental to what we do. And by the way, the great Tom Soni, Johnny Thompson, who he and Pam have been my show business parents since I was 16, I wrote him about it and he wrote me a long, lovely letter about where my head should, what I should consider before doing that sort of thing. And the other person that was instrumental was my Jewish mother, who usually says things that are not helpful at all. So
your mother is everywhere.
It's called Breaking Out of Show Business. There's an ebook and the hard copy. No audiobook yet. I would like to do that. I just haven't. All my entertainer friends really have been so generous. They call me, they're like, oh, were you talking about me in that? Or, oh, I really connected with that. Or, oh, I just realized it's really a bit of therapy for people, and yet not a long droning on thing. It's a bunch of little short stories, which is fun.
Excellent. I'm going to put that link for Amazon. You can get it on Amazon, right?
You can, absolutely. Amazon or Barnes & Noble.
Okay, Amazon, Barnes & Noble. I'll put at least one of those links on your show notes page.
Thanks.
So great. Someone just click on that and go to it. In fact, what you were just talking about, Peter Menny, who was the one that referred you to this, had a question and you answered it a bit in the final PDF. He said, why did you not follow its title of your book of Leaving Showbiz?
Right. So the truth is I tried. I mean, I went to a career coach, and I said, does my 28-year career in show business have any merit in the real world? Mm-hmm. And the person said, absolutely. And we talked about, you know, aside from production, we talked about marketing and we talked about branding and we talked about, you know, all that sort of stuff. They tell me what the jobs are that I was applying for. I'm like, that's what you have to do. That's how long it is. That's how much time you have. That's who I have to listen to. That sounds awful. And nothing sounded exactly right. So what I finally realized was, you know, the things that I was unhappy with are the same bag of rocks that everyone complains with. It's just in a different bag. It's a different wrapping. You know, the people that are lawyers or housewives or, you know, whatever, they're all complaining and worried about the same things. How am I going to end up in life? I feel stale. I don't like this or that. And so I realized that there are things I can do to A, make my life feel fresher, and also how to move myself forward. I think a lot of us that are working professionals get into this horrible pocket of creating or manufacturing for our work because now we have to be good. Now it has to do something. Now it has to be seen. Now it has to be judged. And the problem with that is when we were in our teens and 20s working on our act, we were doing it just for the experience. Hey, I wonder if I know how to do this. Hey, this will be exciting. What could happen with this? You know, when your creative has to pay your bills, it can kind of poison the well. So I think that you lose a lot of that and you don't give yourself the permission to be bad publicly. Mm-hmm. And I think that is wrong. You know, I used to write a blog on the Huffington Post, and I wrote this blog once about how one night I had bombed and I got a lot of emails from old style acts. They're like, you know, you should never say when you bomb and this and that. And you know, when you're young, I think that's true. You're building your brand and people want confidence. Or when you're much older, maybe you're having trouble getting bookings. You don't want people to think you've lost your thing. But I think people want to know, and I got a ton of emails in private. They didn't do it publicly. I'm so glad you said this. I feel the same way. I thought you never bombed. Thank you so much. So it's the same thing with why I didn't quit and why I put the epilogue in, because I started going back to how I was in my 20s, giving myself permission to do things that I might be bad at and without the expectancy of a result. Yeah.
In fact, I'm just thinking back on my own career. It is kind of funny how in our, like exactly what you're saying, in your 20s and 30s, I learned to juggle because I loved it. It's simple as that.
Right.
had nothing to do with having to pay the bills or having to have a great act. But now that I'm older and I've had acts that have been very successful over the years. Now, when I put something out, I don't want to fail in public.
Right. I've been working on a character for about 9 months now, and it is still not good, and it is aggravating and depressing and scary.
I think that one of the mistakes that young artists make is they look at you or myself that have been doing it for 20, 30 years, and they say, oh, well, I want my character to be that strong. And they're 20 years old and have just been doing their variety art for a year.
Right. You don't know who you are yet. And so if you're going to make up a character as opposed to being yourself, you have to do some digging as far as what that behavior means to you as a person, because that's where you pull from to get the real stuff. So it's not just set up punchline where it doesn't feel real. You know what I mean?
Yep.
You know, you got to be all in with it. And people at that age, you don't know yourself well enough yet.
Yeah.
That being said, you also got to look at yourself. Look, for years in the, 90s, I wore like bright, it was the 80s, 90s, I'm wearing like bright suits and sneakers and all that. And then eventually I thought, oh, I'm the money act now. I'm doing well. I should wear like a suit. So I wore like a tux suit. And then years later, when I started losing my hair, I'm like, oh, you kind of look like an old Jew in the Catskills. You should stop doing that. All those things help to move things forward, as far as staying current and not feeling stale.
Yeah. The staying current thing is something that I struggle with myself. I've been doing it for a long time, and the things that worked 10 years ago aren't necessarily working now, and I have to constantly be changing those things.
Yeah, and the question is it the material that doesn't work for today's sensibility, or is it, I don't want to say who it is, but I just saw a magician who, when he was probably 22, he was hot and he wore one of those ruffle open pirate shirts with sexy dancers. And now he has a gut and he has a gobble on his chin and he's still, I'm like, why are you, that is not who you are anymore. Unless you're going to go exaggerated and just be a cartoon of that. It's not going to take much to change your look, dress differently, do a tweak to it where you're doing that character, but it doesn't pay off. I have a friend of mine whose act is, he's an older act and his act has become very politically incorrect. Mm-hmm. And he was having problems getting booked. And I said, listen, here's what you need to do. You need to do kind of like a one-man show type of act about the act that no longer works because it's politically incorrect and you're screwed. And then you can kind of do the act and see, that's the exact thing that I can't do anymore when you're still doing the material, but making it like an arc, like a story arc about how you're suffering and where do you belong and all that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. There are ways to not throw away what you've been doing for 25 years.
That's a great strategy.
You just need to let go and not be so scared.
All right. So we're going to move on to fact or something John just made up. Does that sound like fun?
Yeah, sure.
Okay, let's bring it on.
Wait, are you talking about yourself in the third person?
Yeah, I just did.
Okay, great.
Okay, something that I just made up. See, that doesn't sound as cool, right?
Right. Michael will be answering.
Okay, John will be asking.
Great, we're all here.
Is it fact? Or is it something John just made up?
Here's what's going to happen. I'm going to say a headline. You're going to tell me whether it's true or not. And if it is, tell me a story.
Okay.
First headline. Michael used to dress up like a courier and drop his demos and scripts on the desk of celebs and execs.
That is true. Before I had agents and I was desperate for people to see me, I would dress up like a courier and I'd go to William Morris and I'd say, hey, this is for Bob Green. And they're like, we'll take it. I'm like, he has to take it and sign for it. I had a fake signing clipboard and everything. And they're like, hey, this is William Morris Television. I'm like, oh, congratulations. I'm Courier Express. I have 10 more stops to make today. So they didn't know what to do. They unlock the elevator door. I go up to the 80th floor. They'd sign for it. I come back the next week for a meeting. I'd shave. They think I was somebody else.
Oh man, that's great.
That's how I got my jokes on Bill Maher too. I drove onto the lot. I pretended I didn't even know the name of the show. I'm like, yeah, real turn. They're like, real time. It's down there. I'm like, okay, thanks.
And you're in your outfit.
Yeah.
Your courier outfit.
Well, if we're not in show business, we wouldn't care who they are. They're not curing cancer. They're not saving children. Screw them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Next one. Michael sneaked past security to meet the Queen of England.
That is true.
Oh,
just like the package thing. I was, I was a new act. I was doing a show at a hotel. The Queen of England was doing a tour of the of her Commonwealth, islands and whatnot. And the cast of the show was invited to this 12 o'clock tea ceremony. I'm like, I want to meet the Queen. Mm-hmm. Now, it was for some Black Caucus thing. So I was like the only white guy there. But I dressed up. I was already wearing a suit. I put on dark glasses. I put on my hotel badge as someone who works at the hotel. I got a little clipboard. I put paperwork in it. I stepped over the red velvet ropes. And there were three different security teams there. So they all thought I was with somebody else. So when they're looking at the crowd, telling them to back, they're like, all right, everyone back it up. And I'd be like, okay, back it up, you know. She comes in with the prime minister and her husband. I threw the clipboard behind a tree. I stepped into line and I really just wanted to meet her. And then it turned into like a 4-minute conversation. And then about a month later, some press guy had a picture of it and sent it to me, you know. But it's this picture, like she's clamping her purse and I had big hair, and it's not a quality picture. But I mean, it's a nice looking picture, but it's very dated and terrible.
But it's you and the Queen.
It's me and the Queen. And then I went back to my room after we had spoken. And then I got a call that they wanted me to perform that night for her at this thing. And I was a young act. Like I just did a bunch of dick jokes. You know, I didn't know what I was going to do. And I was in a panic. I had one clean joke and I just stretched it for like 4 minutes and then got off. You know, I'm so glad. I was thrilled someone gave me a picture, because you can't like put your arm around her and hold up a selfie. There were no selfies back then. And what do you say to her? You know, hey, yeah. You know, how are the kids? What's in the purse? You know, is that your scepter? Are you just happy to see me? I don't know what to say, you know.
Yeah, I don't know. She's the Queen, you know. What do you say?
She is the Queen, yeah.
Yeah. All right, next one. Michael's ritual before any gig is to eat an entire bag of M&Ms.
So first of all, I will say that is not my ritual, although okay. I have done that. I like peanut M&Ms and I like the almond ones. And I like when the bags say, oh, it's a sharing, please. Yeah, I do like peanut M&Ms a lot. I know people are allergic to peanuts, but you know, hey, I need my fix.
That's right.
I can't eat or drink really before I go on, because it affects the ventriloquism, the throat. So
yeah, I do the same thing. I don't eat or drink, because then I like throw up on the kids. And
right. Well, I would pay to see that.
Yeah, but then they want you to, you know, continue. And I'm like, throwing up is not in my contract, I don't think.
Hey, oh, really? Well, it would be great once, but then to be forced to do it all the time would be a burden.
Yeah, that would be a burden, wouldn't it? Yeah, you don't get rehired for that one.
No.
Yeah. All right, next one. I think we've beaten that dead horse. Michael once tracked down a robber to retrieve his stolen laptop.
That is true.
Oh,
I was living in a building. I had gone down to the laundry room. I had left my door unlocked. And when I came back, I saw someone running out of my apartment with my laptop. And come to find out that a lady in the building had gone on Craigslist and answered an ad for someone to come fix their refrigerator. And this guy's ad, he had a picture and they had corresponded back and forth, and the police weren't going to help me. And so I decided to find the guy online and ask him to come fix my refrigerator. Then when he realized he knew who I was, he's like, I know what you're doing and you can't have your laptop. And I tried to make a deal with him. He's like, if you leave money in this place, I'll leave the laptop. He's like, you can trust me. I'm like, you stole my laptop. I'm not going to trust you. So I said, look, you're not going to be able to open it. The battery's almost dead. It's on a security lock. There's nothing you can do with it. I said, I'll give you $100 just to give it back, and so I don't have to go get another one. Mm-hmm. He didn't want to do that. And I was so mad that human beings behave this way that I took his picture. I knew kind of where he lived because he had told the lady where he was walking from. And so I made a flyer with his picture, and I wrote that there was a reward and that we have a thief in our neighborhood, and kind of one of those take your neighborhood back kind of thing.
Good.
And I plastered his picture all over this 3-block radius with a Google phone number. And I got a call that someone saw him on the street. I don't know what I'm going to do when I find him, but I'm driving there. I pull into this 7-Eleven while I'm waiting, and there's cops are there. I tell them the story. Then I get a phone call. Oh, and I'm seeing all the posters, and his face is has been ripped out of the posters, which means he's ripping his face out of the posters. Mm-hmm. And finally I get a call. He's like, hey, do you want your laptop back? I'm like, yeah. He goes, you got to stop putting up those pictures. I'm like, you got to stop stealing from people. I'm really sorry. I needed it. I'm really apologetic. Here's where the laptop is. It's under a bucket in a garage, la, la, la. I tell the police. They go with me. We recover it. Well, first they're like, the police are like, oh, it's in the garage over there. I'm like, well, you go get it. You have the gun.
That's right.
Yeah. And I got my laptop back and I fought crime.
Wow. Did he get arrested or anything by the cop? Did the cops do anything?
You know, they took his picture and his name and all that, but I'm sure nothing happened. You know.
All right. So that was a fact or something I just made up.
That was fact. Or something John just made up.
How about some advice for the beginner?
For the beginners, the thing that makes your act the most interesting is finding something about yourself that is exclusively about you. It could be anything from you hate carbs, you love one particular musician, it should be something personal that is really about your personality, and then you blow that up, and that's your act, that's your arc. Maybe if you hate potato chips, like at the beginning of your act, it's how you don't like them, or you'll do anything without them, or you'll have the potato chips in your act, but you won't eat them, and then at the end you eat them, and you have go into, you know, gluten shock because you have celiac, and you die. I don't know. I'm just saying that whatever it is, whatever is the most you is what's going to be the most interesting to the audience.
Yeah, that's true.
And the act and the songs or the tricks or the puppets or the jokes will be colored and will be designed by whatever your agenda is for that message. You know, it's not enough to say my message is about because I love magic and I want to share it with you. Everyone's done that. The audience turns off, or a singer that says, I love the divas. Here's the divas. Okay. Everyone's done that. I don't need you to give me a documentary history on the divas that I can hear from the actual divas themselves. What does it mean to you? And that is the interesting thread. Mm. I think that's the most important thing.
How about some advice for the working pro?
For me, the most important advice for the working pro is your mental state. Mm. Either the panic of having to be booked or be accepted or feeling stale or moving forward. You know, mental health is the most important thing. So you need to surround yourself with people that are going to make you feel good about what you're doing, how to unlock the things that get in your way, which is usually fear or ego. If you can work on that and if you can kind of partner with those insecure feelings, you will be able to do anything you want.
Right. All right. I'm going to ask for a recommended book and then we'll get you out of here.
Sure. Like I said, for some reason, everyone thinks they have to be funny. I think that if you come up with the thing that's the most interesting about you or a personality trait, as we talked about for before, the comedy will come. But if you really want to know about comedy and how to write for yourself, obviously technique comes first, the technical side. There's a great old book called Stand Up Comedy, The Book by Judy Carter, and it does help you with structure first.
Excellent. Yeah. Excellent. Well, thank you for doing my show. That was really fun.
I hope I didn't bore you too much, but I think it's an important podcast, you know.
You are a kick, man. I had a great time.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Do you have some social media you want to promote?
Yes, my website with all the more detailed gunk is at michaelpaulonline.com. Otherwise, through social media, I'm all at Michael Paul Live.
All across the board.
Yes, sir.
Excellent. And thanks to my variety artists. If you found this podcast valuable, tell a friend to listen. Say, listen to this podcast. That's how we can spread the word. You can reach me at john@thevarietyartist.com or join my Facebook group at The Variety Artist, where you can ask me to ask questions of our guests. Now go out and book those gigs, make some money, and have some fun.
That's all for this episode of The Variety Artist. But your journey continues on our website. Go to thevarietyartist.com for more strategies, insight, and resources, as well as show notes on today's guest to assist you in your career. We'll see you on the next episode of The Variety Artist. But until then, go out and book those gigs, make some money, and have some fun.